this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page with the cover story headline, HMOs are coming back, sort of, and you just might like them. New healthcare delivery model could reduce patient choices, but in the long run could help curb runaway costs. That's the headline on the front page. The actual article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with another headline. New health plans, miracle cure, or same old HMO. Triangle employers and providers collaborate for cost control. And this article is written by Jason DeBruin. The Triangle's healthcare landscape stands on the cusp of a potentially monumental shift in how workers with employer-based insurance receive care. Since leaving the dreaded Health Maintenance Organization, or HMO, model that grew in the 1990s, the pendulum swung toward the fee-for-service model as the preferred relationship between insurer and healthcare system. That model, however, now serves as the blame child for escalating costs. Now, health systems, with a nudge from the Obama administration, are moving toward a model that reinstates some aspects of HMOs, call it version 3.0. This new model goes by the name provider-led plan, or some variations that highlight paying for value. With these plans, there exists the potential for savings, as the newer model promises to increase doctor communication, cut down on duplicative tests, and help providers care for patients more holistically, keeping them healthy at lower cost than simply treating diseases as they pop up. All of this could translate to lower premiums and out-of-pocket costs for patients. But there are also risks. This new model will reduce choice of providers, and patients could see more services denied in the name of saving money. The established system in which a physician fights for a new test, even if a health insurance carrier denies the request, could also go away if the health system and insurer are sitting on the same side of the table. Furthermore, some experts say health systems overestimate the savings they can achieve and lack the historical know-how to properly manage the financial risk that comes with insuring patients. No matter how it's sliced, this is a high-stakes game. The nation's health care bill now tops $3 trillion and is by every measure an unsustainable track relative to gross domestic product. A new system that brings together insurers and providers could provide the silver bullet, or it could wreak havoc on patient care. How the plans work. While no fully functioning provider-led plan exists in the Triangle at this point, health systems and health insurers are dipping their toes in a river that could one day lead them to something similar. In late December, Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina and Novant Health reached an agreement in which the insurer, quote, rewards doctors and hospitals for the quality, satisfaction, and outcomes of caring for patients rather than simply paying for the volume of tests or services, unquote, according to Blue Cross. Under the agreement, the insurer and health provider say they will work together to prevent unnecessary hospital readmissions and share relevant clinical data with doctors and patients to help them make more informed healthcare decisions. When a health system and insurer work together on solutions to control costs while providing access to high-quality care, everybody wins, says BCBSNC Chief Executive Brad Wilson. When we sit down with providers in our communities to review contracts, this is our goal. Patients could see more touch points with Novant care givers who might check in more often to make sure they are following doctor's orders. Some could see this as their doctor taking a higher interest in their health, though others might view it as simply invasive. BCBSNC also sells plans marketed as Blue Local and Blue Value, best described as narrow networks, meaning the consumer chooses a plan that offers a more narrow selection of in-network providers, typically contained within one or two health systems. Patients beware. For patients, consumer advocates say there aren't necessarily new pitfalls with these new kinds of plans, but existing pitfalls are potentially deeper. It has always been important for consumers to select health insurance plans that meet their needs, But as plans become more precise, consumers must pay closer attention to what each product option includes and excludes. Unfortunately, consumers have historically not had good tools to evaluate plans in simplistic terms. Insurance carriers provide a list of providers considered in-network, but the list can contain thousands of names, daunting to sift through, and be filled with doctors who are not accepting new patients, shift practice focus, or even moved out of state. The tools for consumers to assess the adequacy of their networks are very poor, says Lynn Quincy, director of Healthcare Value Hub, a division of the independent nonprofit Consumer Reports. To be sure, states, including North Carolina, have laws to ensure health plans meet certain minimum standards with respect to network adequacy, but health insurers can typically simply self-attest that a product qualifies. Adam Linker, co-director of the Health Access Coalition, a division of the North Carolina Justice Center, emphasizes that consumers need transparency and robust protections, and called on regulators to make sure plan designs don't discriminate against high-risk groups. We've seen this especially with cost-sharing for medications, he says. Then there is the matter of knowing how costs will affect consumers. Quincy says a surprisingly small number of consumers truly understand the relationship between premiums, co-pays, and deductibles, and can sit vulnerable to a large bill if they choose a plan that offers a low premium but an out-of-pocket maximum in the thousands. The fact that shopping for health insurance is difficult might help explain why consumers hate it so much. An e-health survey showed that Americans would prefer to go to the gym or even do their taxes over shopping for health insurance. While regulators might argue consumers would want better tools to shop for insurance, and on an individual level, Americans tell Quincy they would like help, Americans philosophically want less government intrusion, so their perspectives in the ballot box differ than their opinions during open enrollment. I really think if you press the entire population of North Carolina on that topic, they would say they want their regulators to clean up the health insurance marketplace, providing only good choices and highly actionable side-by-side comparisons about potential out-of-pocket spending, strength of the network, and likelihood of surprise out-of-network bills, says Quincy. Consumer advocates agree that a defined network of qualified doctors who provide good care would indeed improve health and reduce costs. However, reaching an ideal might prove difficult. In these cases, consumers need strong network adequacy protections, and they should be shielded from surprise out-of-network bills, says Linker. Choice versus cost control. In short, this new model brings healthcare delivery and health insurance into the same tent. At first blush, it makes sense that health systems see this as a better model. After all, what health system doesn't think it provides outstanding and efficient care? To leverage outstanding and efficient care, the argument goes, health systems could form partnerships with insurers to sell insurance that mostly excludes providers from competing systems. They can do this by designing a copay structure in which patients pay far more to see a provider in the UNC healthcare network than those inside the Duke health system, or vice versa, for example. Under this model, patients receive care largely within one network of providers, which coordinate care and have an incentive to keep their patients healthy, a potential win across the board. Indeed, uncoordinated care drives up costs. A recent study published by the Institute for Healthcare Innovation Strategies estimates that uncoordinated care costs an average of $240 billion per year. A significant chunk of that inefficient care happens because patients will go to Health System A for an MRI, for example, and later go to Health System B, which calls for another MRI, with the providers from those systems never communicating. Consider that there were 788,584 MRI procedures performed in North Carolina in the 2013 to 2014 fiscal year, according to the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services, including 65,206 in Durham, 38,299 in Orange, and 96,131 in Wake counties. Depending on the body part being scanned and the hospital where the scan happens, an MRI procedure could cost between $800 and $2,500. Reducing MRI scan procedures by even just 10% could potentially save tens of millions in spending just in North Carolina. Local pioneers. Other examples that bring providers closer to insurers are taking shape. UNC Healthcare has formed a partnership with Cisco Systems in a relationship that could see the health system financially rewarded if it meets quality and cost metrics. While still a far cry from a full-on provider-led insurance package, this relationship represents a step away from the fee-for-service model. Already, UNC runs a primary care clinic on the Cisco RTP campus exclusively for Cisco employees and their families, also seen as a step toward new partnership models. We definitely see this as something that's not just us, but other health systems are going to try, says Dr. Alan DeGurd, president of UNC Physicians. We want to go ahead and learn from this, he says. Cisco owns all the fixed assets, but the doctors work for the UNC Physicians Network and are not Cisco employees. The clinic is basically a UNC Healthcare primary care practice on the ground floor of Building 9 of Cisco's RTP campus. Cisco employees interact with the UNC Healthcare billing system with copays running exactly like they would if they visited a different UNC clinic. Depending on the insurance plan, some services are fully covered, and employees receive a bill from UNC, not Cisco, for those services that require a copay. Ed Paradise, Cisco's RTP site lead, says the company wants to bring a benefit to employees that can help them lead healthier lives. That achieves multiple benefits to the company, after all. Healthier employees are more productive and reduce healthcare costs borne by Cisco. The goal is to have happier and healthier employees, Paradise says. Sandeep Banda, a senior IT engineer, has already made regular visits. He recognizes he has other doctor choices. But for me, convenience is the priority, he says. Colleen Coogan, an IT analyst who has worked for Cisco for 15 years, saw a benefit as much for her two daughters in college as for herself. While their interaction with the primary care network was haphazard at best, she says they feel comfortable with the Cisco campus and the familiar atmosphere makes it easier to get them into the clinic. That's music to the ears of hospital administrators. After all, Cisco employs 4,800 full-time workers at the RTP site. Add all their dependents and UNC Healthcare has the market cornered on a nice slice of business. The clinic has already seen 1,600 visits, or between 35 and 40 per day. They're taking advantage of it faster than I thought, says Paradise. I'd like to brag about this. New networks, new strategies. The changing landscape has led to a marketing arms race. Duke Health recently launched a full-on campaign titled Plan for Duke, which includes a dedicated website and television commercials to include spots during Sunday afternoon football. WakeMed Health and Hospitals bought a full-page newspaper advertisement to encourage patients to choose health insurance plans that include the Wake County system. For the past 30 years, employers have said every provider needs to be in the network and then asked who has the lowest cost, says Rick Kelly, division manager with benefits consulting company Marsh & McLennan Agency. Now the employer community is saying, I don't need every provider in the network. What I need are my employees having access to the right providers at the right time for the right reasons. UNC is also building out a clinically integrated CIN of providers that includes those employed directly by the health system and independent physicians. This network could one day be attractive to insurance carriers for a more closely knit contract. Referring to the CIN, Dr. Seth Glickman, Executive Medical Director of UNC Health Alliance, says, the main reason why we are doing this is to really focus on how do we work together and better coordinate care as physicians to focus on the triple aim of improving outcomes and reducing the total cost of care. The business risks. As providers take on more responsibility for costs of care, they also take on more financial risk. In the fee-for-service insurance model, health insurance carriers held all the risk of insuring patients. As such, the carriers could deny claims if they deemed a service unnecessary and too expensive. Under this model, healthcare providers held no financial incentive to keep services in check, something that led to providers recommending patients receive MRIs, X-rays, or CT scans, even if the benefits of these tests were minimal. The providers could run the test and send the insurer a bill, receiving a fee for service. This contributed to runaway healthcare costs for the past 15 years and was an aspect of the healthcare system that the Affordable Care Act set out to disrupt. Under a provider-led model, or one in which providers share at least some risk, suddenly the health system is on the hook to pay the fees for these services and might think twice before suggesting an MRI for every slight bump of the head. This could save money by cutting down on all those times an expensive test is avoided for a minor bump, but also puts patients at higher risk that a health system could forego a necessary test in the name of saving money. Supporters of such a model present a different theory. Any shift toward a true patient-centered medical home would improve the likelihood that providers can keep their patients healthier and see them more engaged in proper screening, drug adherence, and the like. Then providers would determine appropriate care and not need carrier approval. Analysts say this is why it is important to have quality outcomes as an integral part of any new plan model, so patients and providers can benchmark health metrics like blood pressure, cholesterol levels, and more. Providers aren't insurers. While a system that shifts risks to providers presents potential concerns for patients, there are also potential downsides for the health system. Experts say the very providers entering the market might be overestimating the benefits. For one, insurers have a long track record of running actuarial algorithms. Providers do not. And there are the aspects of selling, general, and administrative operations. In a provider-led system, the provider is really doing everything, Kelly says. So that includes trying to do the marketing and the selling to the employer community, as opposed to having the carrier leverage its distribution system. Brian Bickley, vice president of Scott Insurance, a division of James A. Scott & Son, Incorporated, says healthcare provider hubris plays a role as well. The provider community has generally overestimated their value and their ability to control healthcare costs, he says. Not your father's HMO. While these new insurance products borrow some aspects of the old HMO models, those from both the insurance and health provider camps quickly say the model works differently. For one thing, these value-based models are less restrictive than the HMO models, which became known as Mother May I plans. There were lessons learned in the past, says Wilson, the BCBSNC CEO. There is more flexibility built in the products. Wilson prefers the phrase collaboration between provider, insurer, and patient in order to reach the best outcomes. In fact, I would argue that the only way to get higher quality and lower costs faster is with the cooperation and collaboration, he says. It will not happen without that. Technology advances also differentiate these products from those in the 1990s. Providers now have better access to patient records and population health statistics to better predict the highest risk patients and ways to help manage care, even when the patients are not in the doctor's office. But it is too soon to tell whether the new plans are the magic cure for escalating healthcare costs. A recent McKinsey & Company report on provider-led plans sums its conclusion succinctly. By offering its own health plan, a hospital system may be able to gain a variety of strategic and economic advantages. The move is not without risk, however, and often the risk is greater than the potential benefits. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Rebecca Troyer. Midtown Grill taps new executive chef. North Raleigh's Midtown Grill has a new executive chef. Chef John Childers, who most recently was the chef de cuisine at Heron's at the Umstead Hotel and Spa, will take over chef's duties at Midtown as of January 11. I am beyond excited for the opportunity to apply what I have been taught and have learned to running the kitchen at Midtown Grill, says Childers. I look forward to working with the team to bring some new ideas and to continue to build upon the solid reputation Midtown Grill has developed for a quality dining experience. Childer spent the past 7 years at Herons, where he worked alongside chefs Scott Crawford and Stephen Green. Childers will replace chef Benjamin Harris, who will head back to South Carolina, where he'll become the executive chef at Pugin's Porch in Charleston. Look forward to a new menu inspired by Chef Childers to be available in February. Kane elected to Alexandria REIT, REIT Board of Directors. Ambassador James Jim Kane has been elected to the Board of Directors of Alexandria Real Estate Equities Incorporated, a Pasadena, California Real Estate Investment Trust, or REIT, REIT, focused on collaborative science and technology campuses, including the recently announced Alexandria Center for Science, Technology, and Agriculture, a mammoth project coming to Research Triangle Park. Kane tells Biz his involvement with Alexandria began during his diplomatic service as U.S. ambassador to the Kingdom of Denmark, when Alexandria co-founder Joel Marcus came to Copenhagen to discuss the possibility of developing a life sciences cluster in Scandinavia. As Alexandria was an American company, of course we were delighted to encourage and support their efforts, says Kane. While Alexandria elected not to expand their footprint into Scandinavia, I was extremely pleased to see that they continued to expand in my home state of North Carolina, and particularly the Research Triangle Park. Joel Marcus understands better than most the potential for the life science, biotech, and ag tech cluster in this region, particularly if we can increase our cross-sector and cross-institution collaborations, he said. Food truck owners hit the seas with Shark Tank celeb. Wake Forest resident Deb Keller can tell you exactly how the lobster got from the Atlantic Ocean to her food truck. Keller, the local franchisee of Cousins Maine Lobster, a food truck business launched in Los Angeles by two cousins from Maine, just returned from a trip to the Northeast. She, along with other franchisees from across the country, attended a four-day-long conference in Maine, where she got to go out on a boat and track lobsters with the pros. With her was a surprise guest, Barbara Corcoran, the Shark Tank investor who helped Cousins Maine Lobster get its footing. The visit was captured on the January 5 episode of the ABC series. She's just a fabulous woman, Keller says of Corcoran. UNC law grad has role in Netflix hit. A UNC School of Law graduate is getting some unprecedented publicity thanks to a newly released Netflix documentary series everyone seems to be talking about, Making of a Murderer. Jerome Buting, a Wisconsin-based criminal defense attorney, graduated from law school in Chapel Hill in 1981. More than 20 years later, he was among the attorneys representing accused killer Stephen Avery. Avery, who had been exonerated after spending 18 years in prison on sexual assault charges, enjoyed 2 years of freedom before being charged with murder. In the documentary, Buting and the team insinuate that the local sheriff's department may have set him up after Avery filed a $36 million lawsuit against Manitowoc County for the prior false imprisonment. Biz won't give away the ending of the 10-episode series, but know that all these years later, Budding's queries are still sparking conversations across the country. And in a section called You Said It, reader Facebook comments on recent TBJ stories, on Slide the City Returning to Raleigh, only one extra lane, then it is going to have to sell significantly fewer tickets than last year, I would think, says Cheryl Klein. Charlie Felicitas says, on new hotels, add 1,000 rooms in the Triangle in 2015 and more on the way. It is going to be fantastic. All these new apartments, hotels, office buildings, and an infrastructure basically from the 50s. On Hillsborough restaurants, featured in New York Times travel story, Sharon Logue says, yep, but the beauty of going there is that it's under the radar of all the foodie nuts, which is about to change. And on Forbes, Raleigh is number 2 among cities building the most new housing. Karen Smith says, While I am glad about the new opportunities growth will bring, it makes me sad to see the semi-rural home I chose when I moved here turned into sprawling neighborhoods. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Real Estate page written by Amanda Hoyle. The main headline, Top CRE Transactions of 2015. Triangle sees a year of record-breaking deals. The Triangle's commercial real estate markets closed out a second record-breaking year in a row for investment sales with more than $3.8 billion in transactions in 2015. That's according to a preliminary tally by Triangle Business Journal. Of all major commercial property sales of $7 million or more that were recorded throughout the year in Wake, Durham, and Orange counties, the 2015 total tops the $3.63 million in sales that were recorded in 2014, according to records kept by CBRE Raleigh. It was certainly a big year, says Jeff Glenn of CBRE Raleigh's investment properties team. And while the sale of apartment communities were still popular among investors in 2015, Glenn says the highlight of the year was the resurgence of the office property market. Topping the deals of the year in 2015 was Duke Realty Corporation's nearly $500 million sale of its entire suburban office building portfolio in the Triangle, including 23 buildings in Raleigh, Morrisville, and Cary. If you look at the fundamentals for the office investment market, it should have been a big year, says Ben Kilgore, also of CBRE Raleigh. There's not been much construction. The vacancy rates are coming down. Rents are going up. Raleigh is back on the radar screen for a lot of institutional investors. The warehouse and industrial markets will also be top of mind for institutional investors going into 2016, says Chris Norvell of HFF. He says the market should see more deals like the $21 million sale of the two buildings at New Hope Business Center in East Raleigh in December. The building sold for close to $85 per square foot, which is one of the highest rates ever paid for a warehouse property in the Carolinas. The amount of institutional and private equity money across the country that is targeting industrial right now is staggering, Norvell says. It'll be interesting to see how things will play out this year. New 10-story Residence Inn breaks ground in downtown Raleigh. After several years of negotiations, delays, and redesigns, Raleigh hotel development firm Summit Hospitality Group on January 7 broke ground on its new $30 million Residence Inn Raleigh downtown hotel. The 10-story building project is slated to add 175 hotel guest rooms to the downtown Raleigh hotel inventory when it opens in early 2017 across from the Raleigh Convention Center. Hotel developers in the Triangle added 995 hotel rooms to inventory in 2015 with the opening of 8 new properties. In 2016, the Triangle market is expected to have as many as 8 more hotel properties under construction that could potentially add 1,057 new rooms by early 2017. Among the new hotels under construction include the Maiton Inn, opening in mid-January in downtown Raleigh, the 133-room AC Hotel at North Hills, the 164-room Stateview Hotel at Centennial Campus, and the 144-room Aloft RDU near Briar Creek and Raleigh-Durham International Airport. Raleigh floral event designer files for bankruptcy protection. Popular Raleigh special events company Fresh Affairs LLC has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection, but owner Lynn Grave says the floral company is still in operation and anticipates no disruption to any of his events already into 2016. All employees are still on payroll, Grave stated in an email. We are heavily booked for 2016 and are ahead of where we were last year at this point. We just needed help getting through a couple of really slow months. The Hive nightclub to rebrand as new concept. The Hive, a late-night club above the Busy Bee at 225 South Wilmington Street in downtown Raleigh, closed as of January 2nd as owners prepare to open a new restaurant and bar in its place. Mash and Louder will be the new Belgian-inspired concept with a focus on the craft of brewing beer, according to its owners, changing the scene from a late-night dance atmosphere to one with a larger menu with food and beer pairings. Duck Donuts coming to North Raleigh. Following its entry into Cary last year, the Outer Banks-based Duck Donuts Bakery is opening a second Triangle location in North Raleigh. The new shop is expected to open in mid-January at 8323 Creedmoor Road in the Kroger-anchored Town North Shopping Center, just south of Strickland Road. Restaurant at Raleigh's City Market closes unexpectedly. The Cajun and Creole-style restaurant, Battistella's, at downtown Raleigh City Market has closed its doors for good. Chef Brian Battistella, a Louisiana transplant, had moved his restaurant to 200 East Martin Street in 2011. A spokesman for City Market says the restaurant space was vacated shortly before Christmas and that it was the restaurant's owner's decision to close. And now we turn to the On Pharmaceuticals page, written by Jason DeBruin. The main headline, Chimerix regroups after failed trial. Dr. Michelle Berry, CEO of Durham-based drug developer Chimerix, might be down, but she isn't out after reporting a failed investigational drug trial. Berry hoped that the clinical trial would show that Chimerix's experimental drug, Brincidivir, could prevent a virus common in some transplant patients. Unfortunately, the trial did not achieve its primary endpoint of preventing clinically significant CMV, cytomegalovirus infections, Berry said during a conference call after announcing the results. The announcement caused Chimerix stock to drop 80%. For context, that means its market value dropped from $1.64 billion to $330 million. While disappointed, Berry said Chimerix would remain committed to this Brincidivir program and its potential, and highlighted that the company still had more than $370 million in capital available for future trials. That total includes about $220 million in cash and short-term investments as of September 30, according to the company's most recent quarterly financial filings. Chimerix had another $160 million in long-term investments. Historically, Chimerix has not given forward-looking burn rate estimates, and Berry did not give specific estimates after the trial results. Through the three quarters of 2015, the company had total operating expenses of $88 million, of which $66 million were related to research and development. Both figures were about double compared to the first three quarters of 2014. We are well capitalized at the moment, but we are taking a very detailed look at every one of our expenditures that were anticipated for 2016 to make sure that we are making those decisions with the data in hand, Berry said. A year after crash, still no report on details or cause. More than a year after a plane piloted by Health Decision CEO Dr. Michael Rosenberg crashed into a Maryland house, killing Rosenberg and five others, the National Transportation Safety Board has still completed only a preliminary report. On December 8, 2014, an Embraer EMB 500 Phenom 100 N100 EQ, piloted by Rosenberg, crashed into a house in Gaithersburg, Maryland, about three-quarters of a mile short of the runway while on approach to Montgomery County Air Park. The crash killed all three passengers and a mother and her two children in the house. NTSB issued a preliminary report on December 17, 2014 that detailed marginal visibility on the day of the crash, but has not issued any other information. NTSB typically issues a preliminary report a short time after any crash, but can take months before issuing a factual report, which provides more information, and then a final probable cause report. NTSB has not given an estimated release date of more information. NTSB representatives have said such reports could take as long as 18 months. And in a section called Big Numbers, that number is $33 million. Durham-based drug developer Novan Therapeutics has raised $33 million in another private placement. This comes just 9 months after Novan announced it raised $50 million, which included an investment from Malin Corporation, which is owned partly by billionaire SaaS founder Jim Goodnight. Novan is developing a treatment for acne that does not include antibiotics, an important distinction given the quickly rising rates of antibiotic resistance. Instead, Novan's experimental treatment called SB204 uses nitric oxide, something human bodies produce naturally, but which scientists have only recently learned to store and control more efficiently. And finally, in a section called They Said It, the quote, "Over the past 15 years, the Hamner has undergone a number of transitions, both with respect to the nature of its work and sources of funding. Despite the best efforts of the Hamner's management and board of directors to explore options to sustain and continue the mission of the organization, unfortunate competitive realities make this decision necessary." And that's the Hamner Institutes for Health Sciences, the Research Triangle Park Group, which has for years sought to advance science, particularly the life sciences, after it ceased operations. Separately, Durham-based population health consulting company Symetrica acquired the assets of the Institute for Chemical Safety Sciences, ICSS, a large Hamner division. Symetrica will house the former Hamner assets in Cytovation, a wholly owned subsidiary, and brought on 29 of the former Hamner division staff, including Rebecca Clewell, now the chief scientific officer of Cytovation. And the next quote, "We have had a very successful year at Cyoderm, moving Zorblissa through the development process so that this therapy can hopefully be available to families with epidermolysis bullosa as quickly as possible." And that quote is from Robert Ryan, Cyoderm co-founder, who saw the company through an acquisition that could ultimately be worth nearly $1 billion. Ryan stepped down as the company's CEO. Now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Technology page, written by Lauren Onisorge. The main headline, "Triangle Innovation Abounds in Vegas." 17 North Carolina entities, including 8 from the Triangle, exhibited at the 2016 Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas this month, along with repeat attendees such as PC giant Lenovo and sensor technology firm Valencell. There were several new additions. Here's who was there: Alco Electronics, Raleigh-based Alco, ALCO, creates audio and video products under the RCA and Venturer brands and is a past CES exhibitor. Carry Audio Design, the Raleigh-based manufacturer, develops high-performance audio and video products and is a frequent attendee of CES. Impulsonic Incorporated, a Carrboro-based startup developing physics-based audio technology for video games, virtual reality, and architectural design. Lenovo, the Chinese electronics giant, which runs its American operation in Morrisville and its enterprise division from RTP, introduced a curved-screened gaming PC and new additions to its smartphone and software portfolio. NSF Assist Nanosystems Center at NC State University. The initiative, sponsored by the National Science Foundation, develops nano-enabled, ultra-low-power wearable devices powered by energy harvested off of your body. Polymer Braille Incorporated, a Raleigh-based startup creating an interactive and refreshable Braille display technology aimed at connecting the visually impaired to the digital world. Valencell, a Raleigh-based wearable tech firm whose partnerships with the likes of Sosh have already resulted in biometric reading armbands and even headphones that play music and measure your heart rate at the same time. And Wireless Research Center of North Carolina, a Wake Forest-based co-working space wireless testing facility funded both by the Golden Leaf Foundation and the town of Wake Forest. The Triangle's top startup funding deals. It was a big money year for the Triangle startups as companies across the spectrum from sexual dysfunction drug developer Sprout Pharmaceuticals to downtown Raleigh tech darling Pendo, scored investor backing in 2015. Here are the top five deals. Sprout Pharmaceuticals, $50 million, June 8. A Raleigh drug developer recently acquired by Valeant for $1 billion that scored approval for what's been called the pink pill, a sexual dysfunction drug for women. Phononic Devices, $44.2 million, January 14. A Durham refrigeration technology company developing technologies for medical laboratories as well as consumer kitchens. Colucid Pharmaceuticals, $37.1 million, January 26. A pharma company focused on treating central nervous system disorders, such as migraines. The company recently moved its headquarters to Cambridge, Massachusetts. AgBiome, $34.5 million, August 21. An agricultural sciences startup planning to open a new 30,000-square-foot greenhouse complex in 2016. And Novon, $30.4 million, December 16. A pharma company backed by longtime Triangle execs Neil Hunter, Cree, and Bob Ingram, Glaxo. The company, which is developing dermatology treatments, later amended the funder to $32.8 million. Bowman tapped to lead Digital Turbine spinoff. Judd Bowman, the Durham entrepreneur behind both Appia and Motricity, has disclosed his third startup, Sift Media, a spinoff of Digital Turbine, the Texas company that purchased Appia in an all-stock deal in 2015. Bowman says Digital Turbine approached him with the idea of spinning off Appia's bidding technology software developed about 18 months before the buyout. Digital Turbine had purchased Appia for its app install product for its $33 million in 2014 sales, not for a newly developed piece of real-time bidding technology. While Bowman insists he had intended to take some time off, it was too enticing an opportunity to pass up. So he assembled a four-person team of Appia and Motricity coding veterans and got to work, registering the company with the state last fall. The focus is on the mobile ad auctions popping up with increased frequency, he says. Our job at Sift is to build the algorithms and the data and the very, very scalable and very fast software to process to sift through those trillions of ads a month to see which ones we should bid on, he says. As part of the licensing deal with Sift, Digital Turbine gets $1 million in cash and 9.9% of the authorized and issued shares, as well as a seat on the new company's board to be filled by its CEO, Bill Stone. And in a section called On the Move, two Morrisville technology companies are making real estate moves in the Triangle, Channel Advisor and Eye Contact. According to a securities filing, Channel Advisor has notified Aerial Center Realty Corporation that it's exercising its right to terminate its lease, dated June 2005, in October, triggering a termination fee of $1,044,635. Channel Advisor was renting space in three buildings at Aerial Center, with lease terms lasting through 2021. In late 2014, the company, which had been looking for additional space for several months, announced it would be moving to Duke Realty Corporation's Perimeter Park, taking on nearly 137,000 square feet and agreeing to pay $3.2 million for the first year of an initial seven-year lease. Morrisville email marketer iContact is preparing to move into a new 29,000 square foot RDU center headquarters in the spring, which is a 30% expansion of its current space. Company representative Jess Knight says it's a major investment and one that confirms parent Cision's commitment to local employees. Cision merged with Vocus, which purchased iContact in a deal valued at $169 million in 2012. In a section called He Said It, we will defend our intellectual property to ensure our current and future licenses get the full value of licensing our inventions as we continue to innovate around our foundational dream of seamless, personalized mobile health and fitness. And that quote is from Steve LaBeouf, a prepared statement by Valencell co-founder and president Steve LaBeouf on a pair of patent infringement lawsuits filed January 4 against Fitbit and Apple. The Valencell team claims products such as the Fitbit Charge and the Apple Watch are infringing on patents related to the Raleigh company's heart sensor technology, and they're asking for jury trials. And now we turn to the A Better World page written by Todd Cohen. The headline of his column, The Arc Focuses on Disabilities. Getting through a typical day can be a challenge for individuals with developmental disabilities, or 1 in 40 North Carolinians, by rough estimates, and possibly a lot more. Depending on the nature and extent of their disabilities, they can find it difficult to get out of bed, get dressed, shop for food, get to work, and even do their job if employed, or make decisions about their health, money, and housing. Working to provide support for people with disabilities is the ARC of North Carolina, an affiliated chapter of the ARC of the United States that also supports 25 local chapters throughout the state. Local chapters provide services to individuals with disabilities or serve as advocates, or both, while the statewide group works to support local chapters and does not compete with them, says John Nash, its executive director. Where services are not available, we provide some direct service, he says. Operating with an annual budget of $16 million and a staff of 700 people, and generating 80% of its funds through Medicaid, the ARC serves 3,000 to 4,000 individuals per year and works as an advocate on disabilities issues. In addition to its Raleigh headquarters, it operates offices in Asheville, Charlotte, Greensboro, and Wilmington, as well as small satellite offices in Greenville, New Bern, and Southern Pines. The ARC works to connect individuals with disabilities to services that range from finding physicians or housing or through a separate purchasing agency with medical equipment such as wheelchairs and hospital beds. It connects individuals with disabilities with people, either independent contractors or its own employees, who can provide 24-hour support for individuals with disabilities. Assigned by clerks of court, it serves as a guardian for individuals with disabilities and works with an agency that provides them with trust and financial services. It supports employment for people with disabilities, assessing their skills and job goals, helping them prepare for and find jobs, and providing job coaches in the workspace if needed. And it connects people with housing. It owns 485 properties throughout the state that house about 2,400 individuals, contracting with other organizations to manage the properties or provide support services for the tenants. The ARC also works as a lobbyist in the State General Assembly. In this year's session, it helped lobby for a law that now allows people with disabilities to use 529 savings accounts to save up to $100,000 without affecting their Social Security, Medicaid, and other benefits that support their disability services. In addition to Medicaid funding, the ARC receives funds from the state and revenue from the low-income housing it owns, including rent from tenants and federal and state rent subsidies. The ARC also is gearing up to generate private support, initially through partnerships with corporations, and within a year aims to launch an effort to raise money from individuals, Nash says. Our goal is to help connect the ARC and people with disabilities across the state with corporations, says Nash, helping us move our mission forward in our advocacy efforts. And in nonprofit news, inmates share the gift of produce. In the past year, inmates at North Carolina prisons and juveniles at Youth Development Center raised more than 35,800 pounds of fresh produce and donated it to local food banks and other service organizations as part of an ongoing initiative to fight hunger in local communities, according to Governor Pat McCrory's office. Winter gardens and warmer-than-usual weather allowed the inmates and juveniles to continue raising fresh produce for food banks and other agencies as late as December. Foundation has a banner year. The North Carolina Community Foundation, under the leadership of CEO Jennifer Toll Whiteside, reached $237 million in total assets and $101 million in lifetime grant making since the foundation's creation 27 years ago, according to its latest annual report. Last fiscal year, $12 million in grants were awarded on behalf of fundholders and affiliates. The largest grant category for the fiscal year was $6.9 million for education. The second largest area of grant making was $1.3 million for human services. The foundation also administers a large number of direct scholarships, awarding $730,430 that allowed 335 students to pursue their post-secondary education last academic year. And now turning to some general news stories in the Triangle Business Journal. This story is headlined, Durham Luring 200 Job Project, written by Amanda Hoyle. Durham City Council is considering an economic development incentive package that could lure an India-based pharmaceutical firm looking to open a new drug research and production facility that could employ 200 people. The company, identified as Project Restorative, in preliminary contract documents that are circulating among City Council members and staff, is expected to also invest at least $31.7 million in improvements to an existing facility within the Durham city limits. While city staff officials were unavailable to comment about the project, other sources have confirmed that the company is Aurobindo Pharma USA Incorporated, the New Jersey-based affiliate of Aurobindo Pharma based in Hyderabad, India. Aurobindo is a manufacturer of generic pharmaceuticals and active pharmaceutical ingredients, including semi-synthetic penicillin. The company received its first FDA generic drug approval for production in the United States in 2004. It has since then expanded its portfolio to 124 additional products on file with the FDA, including generic versions of Alcon's Patanol allergy eye drops, and Warner Chilcott Company's Actonel treatment for osteoporosis, which were both approved for Aurobindo Pharma by the FDA in December. Durham is offering $200,000 to the company if it meets its job creation and investment goals within the next 3 years. City Council had on its agenda for the January 7 work session to discuss its options related to incentives for Aurobindo. Aurobindo Pharma CEO Robert Cunard has not responded to a request for comment, and Aurobindo's leader for North Carolina, Ninad Deshpande, was out of the country and unavailable for comment. Tire giant Bridgestone taps Wilson for expansion. This article is written by Lauren Onasorge. Already 32,000 tires come out of Bridgestone America's Wilson facility each day, and that's set to increase in the next 3 years as the Nashville, Tennessee-based tire operation, part of Bridgestone Corporation, plans to expand the plant. While no new jobs are being credited as a result of the expansion, Wilson officials on January 5 lauded the move, saying that Bridgestone's plans secure the 2,200 positions already working at the facility. The expansion is part of Bridgestone's five-year, $164 million investment to meet market demands and invest in newer, more efficient technology, according to the company. The company will break ground in early 2016 and expects the expanded facility to be operational by 2018. The goal is to expand production capacity and lower costs. The first and second phases of the project, which will total nearly $100 million, will focus on adding 167,000 square feet of manufacturing space to accommodate new tire assembly machines, materials, handling systems, and other equipment, which are expected to increase production by 3,000 tires per day. Our investment in updated equipment and improved manufacturing processes and facilities reflects our focus on maintaining our global competitiveness, as well as our commitment to the Wilson community, said Michael Darr, plant manager, in a prepared statement. The plant is expected to begin producing Drive Guard tires, a product designed to go up to 50 miles to safety after a puncture, later this year in Wilson. Bridgestone has been operating the plant since the early 1970s, with the last expansion happening in 1999, adding 85,000 square feet to the facility. According to the company, the Wilson plant represents about 20% of Bridgestone America's tire manufacturing. And in our remaining minutes with the Triangle Business Journal, we'll read from the People on the Move page. The spotlight is on Jenny Myers, Raleigh-Durham Area Managing Director, Wells Fargo Insurance. Armed with extensive experience in business and commercial banking, Jenny Myers has now taken on the role of Managing Director of Wells Fargo Insurance's Raleigh-Durham office. In her new role, Myers leads business development, client service and sales functions for Wells Fargo's insurance brokerage operations in the local area. Her 35-member team is also focused on strengthening relationships with its bank partners in an effort to serve the risk management and insurance needs of more of Wells Fargo's commercial and corporate customers locally. Wells Fargo Insurance provides middle market, large corporate, and high net worth clients with property and casualty, professional risk, employee benefits, private risk solutions, and targeted insurance programs to specialized industries. WFI currently has 5,200 employees nationwide. What's one thing you wish people knew about your job? At Wells Fargo, the customer is at the center of everything we do. Wells Fargo Insurance wants to help our customers protect what they value most, whether it's their business, home, employees, etc. What are some of your major goals for your new position? I'm excited to grow and strengthen our existing customer relationships, hire more team members, attract new clients, and continue to improve customer service. I also want to look for opportunities for Wells Fargo and its insurance business to become more active in the local community. Biggest pet peeve? Focusing on the transaction instead of the client. When someone is more concerned about the transaction instead of understanding a client's short and long-term priorities and strengthening the overall relationship. And we're going to stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. Our number is 919-832-5138. So long until next time.